In today's episode of the Pivot All About Bikes podcast, we have an impressive amount of history on the plate. Chris Kokelis talks with Richard Cunningham. Each of them influenced the industry in its path, while Chris almost became an accountant and Richard built bikes and started a bike magazine. Their stories alone could cover multiple episodes of our podcast, so they will focus on something specific. It is the 35th anniversary of building bikes for Chris. The history that goes along with it, and how all the talented people working now at Pivot met and discovered their shared vision for excellence. Together with RC, they dive in and discuss the 80s. An idea about a bike, hot neon pink color, bottom brackets with titanium axles that won't break, elevated chainstays, long stems, and fast forward to the bikes we ride today. Pursuing perfection along the way.
Hi, I'm Chris Kokelis with Pivot Cycles, and this is our All About Bikes podcast. Today, I've got a special friend that I've known for a long time, Richard Cunningham, formerly of Mantis Bicycles and Mountain Bike Action fame, and then Pink Bike. For how many years were you at Pink Bike, Richard?
I think about 9 years.
9 years. And now we're just good friends, but we've known each other since 1987, and we're talking about the 35-year anniversary of the first Talon frame, and I thought of really no one better to kind of tell that story and for us to dive into a little bit of the history of the sport and kind of where we're at today, and welcome, Richard.
Yeah. Well, it's good to be here. So we actually met before we made the Talon frame. He showed us, when I was at Mantis, a little bicycle company, and we had some fame, and people used to drop into Mantis all the time from the industry, sometimes as big as Shimano or SunTour, sometimes as small as Little Inventors and stuff. And so I got a call, and he says, "Hey, I want to show you something I built and get your opinion on it." And this guy shows up from Arizona with his girlfriend in tow. That would be Cindy, right?
Yeah.
That's a long relationship right there.
Actually, might have been pre-Cindy, but yeah, it was. I think it was 1987. I had a picture of a Mantis frame up in my dorm room. I was 18 or 19 years old, and a good friend of mine moved out to Southern California. You did a weekly ride, I think, in Chino Hills.
Yep.
And he said he got to ride with Richard Cunningham. And I wanted to come meet you.
That was a tough ride to follow.
Yes.
We had a rule that we would wait for 3 weeks out of the month. And then after that, whoever brought that person into the group had to stay at all the turn points. And then they have 3 months to get up to speed. But we'd wait until the 3 months was over, and that was it. So it was a tough group. But anyway.
I didn't get 3 months, but fortunately I did have my friend, though, who would take me up on those same hills, a lot of switchbacks, and he had gotten extremely fit riding with you guys. He'd ride up to the next switchback and yell, "Come on, pussy." He used to be the wrestling coach at Arizona State University, and he just kind of had that type of attitude.
Oh, my. Well, anyway, so basically, it turned out to be a bottom bracket with external cups. I think it took Shimano how many years to figure out the external cups?
I don't know if that came around 2006, 2007.
Yeah.
That time frame.
But anyway, he shows me this bottom bracket. And was it Snake Cycles, I think it was, right?
Yeah.
Snakes. Everything is a desert theme at Pivot. And now you know. Go to physics. Anyway. So it was this awesome bottom bracket, double rail bearings with external cups, titanium shaft. It was like the bottom bracket. And at the time, almost every mountain bike component came from a road bike somewhere. You know, the brakes came from France. Everything was like substandard. And it turned out that Chris had broken just about everything on a mountain bike by the time it got to the bottom brackets. But it was really good. And one of the things that happened was most of the stuff that we would see, they'd say, "Hey, is this a good mountain bike part? You know, is this crank something that you'd like?" But they would always be in prototype form. Sometimes Shimano or some of the big guys would show us a pre-production thing. But this was like everything. The bottom rack was in production. the box was cool, the packaging. It turns out later on, Chris did all the packaging, even coloring the boxes. But it was in production. It was just, I thought, this guy knows his crap. And I was blown away. And then he, you know, I asked him, are you going to be able to sell these things? Because I'd already been butting heads with the industry on just about every other component. And he goes, yeah, you know, I think I'm going to sell them. And then he drove back to Arizona. And I thought, you know, that guy, I am going to see that guy somewhere down the road. This isn't the last time I'm going to see him. And the next time I heard his name was the Talon. Now, the Talon was an elevated chainstay bike, and I had already established a bit of a reputation for elevated chainstay bikes at Mantis. But what people didn't know is that I had been riding and consulting with the guys at Mountain Bike Action, Zapata Espinoza and Jody Weisel. Whenever they had new bikes, they would bring them over to Mantis, and I'd weigh them and measure them and tell them what I thought about them. And here's this Talon, and it's Chris Kokalis. I'm like, what the hell? So how did that bike come out of your mind after you were the bottom bracket guy?
Yeah, no, it was interesting. The bottom bracket thing was I had just gotten into mountain biking. And from a history of BMX, and I would break a spindle sometimes twice a week. It was just crazy. And I met a machine shop guy and said, you know, like, let's try this and let's support it this way. And basically got it to where the next thing we were breaking was the crank arms, but got the bottom bracket to be reliable. And I just got super into what was going on on the mountain bike side. I had drawn up BMX frames in the past. As I mentioned, I had a picture of your Nishiki Alien elevated chainstay bike hanging up in my dorm room. And I was managing a bike store, and a guy came in, and he was actually the original founder of Norba. And he had braced my partner, Alan Vaughn, at Sun Eagle Bicycle Works. And he had braced this frame, and it was super steep and super weird. And it was not straight. And I rode it around the parking lot, and I'm like, did you build this yourself? And he did. And I had already been doing like full size hand drawings of bicycle frames and what I wanted for my perfect geometry. And so I said, I'll draw the bikes and we can like lay everything out so that they ride great if you'll teach me how to brace. So I started going over to his house in the afternoons and evenings, and that was that. We built, the entire production life of that bike was 12 units maybe, but one of Alan's frames we took to Mountain Bike Action.
Well, it was pretty unique. I mean, there's some pretty crappy bikes out back then, and this was like, you know, it's triangulated well, everything was right. And I'm not sure whether Zapper or the test riders, because I wasn't a test rider at the time. I just saw the bike, and it has a really cool like splatter paint job, which at the time was like the thing, you know,
for sure.
The Jackson Pollock look. And that was the second time. And I thought, well, he's making bikes now, you know. But so did you braze the bikes yourself as well?
Yeah. You know, it was interesting. The one we took to Mountain Bike Action, I was so proud of my first one that I built all by myself, the first pink Talon, and being a selfish 19-year-old kid, there was no way I was going to leave that one, the perfect example, off at the magazine. Now it would be the complete opposite. You always leave the perfect one off at the magazine. So, you know, this one was done a little quicker, and maybe it wasn't quite as straight and the angles weren't as right. And it's like, literally looking back on it, it was not one I would personally ride. So I can't believe like why we would make the decision that that's the one that got left at the magazine. And I felt you guys and Zap was incredibly nice saying that it's a perfect desert machine.
Well, now back to your BMX time. You had a pro license, yeah, out of high school, and you came to Arizona under the guise that you were going to get a college education so you could race BMX. At least that's how the story is that I remember.
Yeah, and that is correct. I had a scholarship to University of Illinois for running track, and I didn't want to stay in Illinois. And I, much to my parents' disappointment, left that and decided to come here simply because I could race every night of the week.
And when you were in Indiana in high school, you took every shop class you could possibly take.
Illinois.
What's the difference between Indiana and Illinois?
A couple L's.
Yeah, and cows. And yeah. Cows, both have cows. Well, they make cars and, yeah, anyway. So
they're both so flat.
I did the same thing. I actually went to summer school before I went to high school so I could take metal shop my first year. And I took metal shop and wood shop, everything. I learned how to operate everything. How is it that you didn't learn how to weld in high school?
You know, I was in auto shop and I went through all kinds of woods classes. So like I made furniture, I made a hydroplane boat, did all this stuff with wood and even did some bicycle frame stuff where I get like crappy Murray's or Huffy's that were Pixie or women's frames and cut the tubes. But then we had a guy at a lawnmower shop and he welded and I just say, you put this here, and he would do it for a few bucks. And yeah, I just never had a welder at the house. Didn't have that skill set at the time.
Well, maybe that's the magic of your whole career, is that if you didn't have a skill, rather than do it poorly, you handed it off to somebody that could do a better job, you know, because you're looking at the end result, at least in my 37 years of knowing you, perfection is like the only goal. Good enough. Yeah,
and you got to find a way.
Yeah. Good enough is how craftsmen work. You know, if you get it as perfect as you can, and if it's outside your skill set, you just, you know, do it as best you can and then don't look at that part when you're done. But that's not you.
Not typically.
So I got a couple of questions. When you were doing BMX, I know you taught, you had BMX classes and, you know, you taught skills. Did you ever want to get into the bicycle industry as somebody, as making stuff, you know, like it wasn't mountain bikes that inspired you to make bicycles and bicycle parts because they suck so much?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't actively trying to get in the bicycle industry. That wasn't like, I want a job in the bicycle industry. I started hanging out at the bike shop in our Chicago suburb when I was 9 years old. It was the Grom they couldn't get rid of. Take out the garbage. Here's some stickers. Go home. and then I was told this story before, but it was basically there was the Parks and Rec had different classes you could take, and one of them was a bicycle repair class, and it was really for parents to take care of their kids' bikes. And the same bike shop that I wouldn't leave alone was putting this class on. So it was, you had to be 16 and I was like 10. And so my mom had to go like petition that I could take the bicycle repair class, and they let me, but it was a one and done thing. It's like, here's how you fix your flats and then bring all your other stuff. And I'd sign up for it every fall, every spring. And so then they would put me in back with the mechanics and go up there, Chris, and they'll teach you how to take apart a 3-speed hub and whatnot. And so I would do that and then just started working in bike shops at some point, about 14, 15 years old. And then eventually working for the shop that I raced for all the way through the time that I stopped racing BMX here.
So, but during that time, BMX bikes were pretty good. So I imagine you didn't have to really reinvent everything, but you were pretty fit. I mean, I see pictures of you back then and you're just like ripped. Your shoulders, your upper body, yeah, looked like you were in the gym every single day and you were just racing BMX every single week.
Yeah, it was all in the off season. It was about lifting weights and we ran like 190, 195 crank arms and big gears. And you basically, sometimes you'd rip the front end off a bike coming out of the gate. It was all about laying down the power as quickly as possible and not about pumping and smooth. And jumps were much more Evel Knievel. You pedal in the air is just a different time. And, but in back in 82, 83, BMX parts sucked. I mean, the cranks were the same size spindle that mountain bikes started with, that road bikes had, you know, 2-degree taper spindle. And you can imagine on a BMX bike with those loads, those things would just break. And my dad would take me back to the bike shop before I was sponsored by the shop. And it was like every week I'd bend or break another crank set or another spindle. That was kind of like things I'd go through. And the name of the shop was Sundance, and the owner, Jim, he took care of me so many times. And then basically was like, maybe this part isn't right for you. And around those times, like Redline Flight Crank came out, and that was big spindle, 3-piece crank, big bearings. And then that problem was solved. But hub flanges would break when they were tall hub flanges.
Yep.
You'd land a little sideways, the wheel would flex, and then the whole hub flange would crack around it. So it's not like I didn't see and experience all this crap. And I had 2 paper routes. My parents didn't buy the stuff for me. So it was frustrating, and to find the stuff that works and then to relive it with mountain bikes.
That's the story I want you to tell, because you pretty much don't have patience for crap. I mean, that's what you told me about why I made the bottom bracket, because I was tired of buying more crappy bottom brackets. So I made my own. But you started mountain biking. Like, I was a pioneer. We were just making mountain bikes and trying to figure out what a mountain bike was supposed to be. When you came onto the scene, you showed us what a mountain bike shouldn't be and set about making all those wrongs right. Your influence took the raw, spindly mountain bikes that we had come up with that were way better than what we had before, and actually brought it into something that what we ride now, something that doesn't break, that you can enjoy and put in your garage and use every single day without taking a tool set. But I could see that the bones of that whole operation happened during that BMX period, because you went through a short but fast evolution through BMX. Now tell us about the 4 mountain bikes that you destroyed before you decided this was going to be the greatest sport in the world.
Yeah, this was actually while I was still in Chicago, and we were out at our dirt jumps, and a kid came by on a black chrome Schwinn High Sierra, and it was the first mountain bike I'd ever seen in person. And, oh, dude, can we check that out? And I hit a couple berms and punched this. We had this one jump that it was a double, and there's pictures of one of my friends in the air over a Volkswagen with his brother standing on the hood on the roof with his hands in the air. So it's a pretty good size jump. So I landed, and the fork broke off, and the head tube broke, and handed this poor kid his brand new bike back. Sorry, dude. And mountain bikes suck. And that was that. And then came out here. And I thought I had saved enough money for school. And I was running out of money after about the first semester. So went and got a job at the local bike shop, and I was the BMX grom. Almost all these guys were into mountain bikes. They were road racers coming into mountain bikes. And, we carried Nishiki and, Fat Chance and Richie. And I borrowed a demo. I forget which model, Nishiki, and I was hooked, and then I put my money down on an employee purchase on a Nishiki Pinnacle.
Ooh. So what year was this?
That was 87.
Ooh, okay.
1987. So I was still living in the dorms. Our dorm was interesting. It was the lowest priced of the dorms, and it was definitely more like a crappy YMCA. And we all open shower heads and everything, and And so I would bring my bike in from a bike ride, and me and my bike would take our shower and wash the bike. And I had only had the bike for 3 weeks. And I mean, I took everything to buy this bike that I owned and had money wise. And I'm washing it, and there's a ripple underneath the down tube behind the head tube.
Oops.
Yeah. And so that bike, the group kit was great. And, I think I had a constant employee purchase account going at the bike shop for as long as I worked there, because I talked to them. They had Fat Chance and everybody that really rode had fat chance. And so,
you were like a coal miner. Every penny that you made, you just went right back into the corporation.
Yeah. If it didn't go to pay for school, it went for that. Yeah. I didn't really need to eat, but yeah, it was interesting because even back then, that's when U-brakes were coming along. And as a bike mechanic, I really fucking hated U-brakes. It was just horrible. And, you know, chain suck and everything else that went along, that just amplified the problem. And Fat Chance wanted to charge $175 more to order a frame with cantilever mounts on it.
It was a lot of money back then.
Yeah, I did it. That's how badly I did not want U-brakes on my bike. So yeah, I custom ordered it, waited for it. It came back then actually in a reasonable time frame, and got that bike, and that was my first real mountain bike, and it was an amazing bike. I had when I met my wife Cindy and we were dating, I talked her into getting a Fat Chance, and then I had a Fat Chance Yoetti after that, and by that time I had already built the talent alongside that and was starting to work on what became Titus. So
basically the initial disappointment faded. So you said after you had your first real mountain bike ride, you were hooked for life.
Yeah.
I think that was in the Pink Bike interview. And it's true. I thought, knowing you all these years, you just have no room for disappointment. And after wrecking the first three bicycles that you've tried, going on a mountain bike ride and coming back and having you say, "This is for me," that's a huge commitment. You must have really liked it. So now you're running two bike shops. You're managing two bike shops. And this guy comes in and he's ranting and raving about some stupid article that said titanium's almost impossible to weld and blah, 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 blah. And he's like, "This is bullshit." And that's kind of the beginning of the first chapter of you as a real mountain bike builder. Am I getting that correct?
Yeah, it was, that was probably, it was 89. His wife was shopping next door and he saw the bicycling magazine on the rack or Bicycle Guide or one of those magazines that existed back then. He bought it and was checking it out while she was shopping. And there was an article on Merlin and the black art of titanium and everything. He just thought it was a bunch of smoke and just brought this magazine in he was talking about how easy it was to build, how easy titanium was to work with. And he worked in aerospace and, you know, I'm still now a cocky 21-year-old that had built frames and parts, and I was basically like, well, I know everything about bicycles, so, you know, if you know everything about titanium, you know, let's do something, because I'm kind of in between my frame building gigs. And so yeah, we started. He was into it. He wasn't a cyclist at all, and he was super into doing something, and we did in fact start building titanium parts and pieces in his garage. And and then that turned into frames. We built steel frames first.
Does this mysterious person have a name?
Mark Zepeda.
Mark Zepeda?
Yeah.
And there is actually aerospace in Phoenix?
Yeah, there's huge aerospace in Phoenix. General Dynamics is here. I mean, the Apache helicopter's built here. Allied Signal Aerospace made Learjet engines, and he worked for the materials testing division of Allied Signal Aerospace. So he was a welder in materials testing lab. So he was interested in this, and we struck up a partnership that eventually, very quickly actually, became Titus.
So how did you get the name Titus?
It's a name he was passionate about. It's refers to a book in the Bible. He was a pretty religious person, and it stood for quality and doing what you say you're going to do. Titus Titanium had a nice ring, and originally we were Titus Titanium. We weren't Titus Cycles because we were only doing titanium products. So yeah, it was, we ran with it.
So let's look at the landscape of when you started Titus, because starting Titus is like everything else was kind of like the drum roll, and starting Titus was like the first hit on the cymbal. So if let's look at the landscape, like at that time, the sport was still primarily cross country, but people were starting to destination cross country.
Yeah.
Where people wanted more rugged bikes because they're going to Moab. They're going to destinations. There was no, I don't think there was any bike parks that were well known, even Whistler back then.
No, Whistler back then, actually bikes were not legal on the mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah, Moab was starting to happen.
Yep.
The kamikaze was happening.
Yeah, it was kind of destinations.
Yeah.
You went to Mammoth and rode at Mammoth. You went to Moab and rode at Moab. And it was just a trail bike didn't have a name, but mountain bikers were starting to deviate from cross country racing, which was like the soul of the sport. Hardtails were still the number one thing. Suspension. When did rock shocks come out? 89 or 88?
I think it was 88. Yeah.
88, 89. So this would be about the time when the first Manitou and rock shock suspensions were out, and the hardtail was kind of like the thing. And then Titus came out. And did you start making bicycles? I mean, you were making stems, right? Bar ends and stems.
Bar ends and stems and bar stem combos and some seat post stuff we were playing with. But really quickly into all of that, we built our first steel frame. And as kind of a prototype of this is what we want. I loved my Fat Chance Yo Eddie. And there was a group of us that managed this chain of bike stores, and we were all into high-end stuff. So I had a buddy who had a Ritchie P21 Philip raised bike, and another friend that all he rode was Bond Triggers. And then I had the Fat Chances and dabbled in. I had one of the first Yetis that had a Fisher oversized head tube on it. And that's actually in that 1988 period, I put a RockShox on it because I folded that, AccuTrax, or it was actually just a Yeti fork, on the first ride, and it just buckled underneath the cantilever studs. And
035 wall, it was
unreal how thin that tubing was and how quickly it folded. And John Parker at the time, they were small enough, he would be the one answering the phone telling me I'm an idiot and didn't know how to ride, and every one of them broke. And that really put Bond Trigger on the map for quality forks. Cause I did have a Bond Trigger fork on it as its replacement briefly.
That was a good fork.
Yeah. That was a fantastic fork. And then the first RockShox. And so, yeah, it was that. And then just being able to ride all those bikes, there was kind of a philosophy when I looked at all of them from my side was, whether it be a Bond Traeger, which had pretty short top tubes and pretty long chainstays, and the Ritchie was a little bit different, but like all the best handling bikes, they all handled good. They just were different in how you fit up on them. And they all had 41.5-inch wheelbases on a medium frame. So that number was just in my head, that whatever bike we built had to have a 41.5-inch wheelbase. And I always wanted a little bit more stretch out of the front of my Fat Chance, and there was some bikes I had ridden with shorter chainstays, and I liked how easy they wheelied. So our first Titus titanium frame was a 1/4-inch taken off the chainstays and added to the top tube to get my 41.5-inch wheelbase but still match my Fat Chance perfectly. The other thing too is, another buddy had one of the first Merlin mountain bikes. It was like number 9 was the serial number, and it was light, but the thing was super flexy and it wasn't straight. And so it was brand new product when Mark came walking into the bike shop with that magazine. And fortunately I had a chance to ride it. And when he started talking about titanium, I did think it was a black art, and it was for the bike industry. It was such a cool thing. I mean, there was no Lightspeed quite yet. There, There was no Dean, all the companies that McMahon, all those early titanium companies, we kind of all launched at about the same time, seemingly. But the big thing was I wanted to build basically something that rode as well as my Yo Eddy, but weighed like the Merlin. It wasn't flexy like the Merlin. And so the finding big titanium tubes, and at the time big was 1.5 inch compared to the like inch and an eighth that Merlin top tubes and down tubes were made out of. Actually, that was a difficult deal, but the first frame was heavy for a titanium frame, but it really rode just like my Fat Chance.
Well, you've been a stickler for stiff, you know, for stiff frames from the beginning.
Yeah, not like aluminum beat the crap out of you stiff, but yeah. You don't want things, chains falling off and tires rubbing and that sort of thing.
So now you started Titus. Now, when did you start building Titus frames? And because you were just doing stems and stuff, bars and stems, which were big sellers. This is the beginning.
We were just playing around. Yeah, I mean, they weren't big sellers. They were big sellers later when Titus existed, but in the garage, they were the experiments of, can we build titanium bike parts and things? But it was probably within the same three-month period that we built the first steel frame. And I got to ride it around a little bit, but I didn't have any money, so I sold it to a friend. And then the first titanium frame, also rode it just to know that I was successful in what I wanted to achieve, but I had to sell it.
You're not the only one.
Yeah.
I think I would hold on to a bike for about 3 or 4 months before I sold my Mantis when I was first starting out, so I could sell it and pay rent and buy more tubing to fill orders. it's not an easy business to make money at, which brings me to the next one. Your first production frame wasn't even your brand. It wasn't even a Titus.
No. So when we did start building some frames, I was at a bike race with one of my bikes, and I met John Rader, who was the person who invented the threadless headset. And he was a big deal at the time. Within 1 year, I think like something like more than 80% of the bikes on the showroom floor went from a gooseneck to a threadless headset. And he had sold that patent to what's now Cane Creek, back then was Diacomp USA. Having that kind of success in the bike industry for somebody that's completely outside of the bike industry, that's just an enthusiast with an idea, he had a great amount of pull. And he had an idea for a suspension bike. And he had tried working with Texas A&M, I believe, to have them build prototypes, and it didn't really go anywhere. And so he asked if I'd be interested in doing these prototypes, and we built the prototypes, and he went shopping to GT and Univega, and Univega bought the bike. So I didn't think anything would come of it from my side. I just built the prototypes and was going on and finishing school, and got a purchase order from Univega for 175 titanium full suspension frames. We weren't in a shop. We weren't really a going concern. I had a drill press where we had to, that I coped the tubes with. It was a Craftsman drill press. We had to put about two size smaller a cutter than what the cope would actually be, because the things shook so bad. And it took so long to make the cope that by the time it finished wallowing itself out, you'd have about the right size cut on the tube. So it was a completely different scene on what we had to use to build the bikes, from going to that to like, should I even accept this? And I think I've talked about this before in other articles and podcasts and things, but I had switched from engineering to accounting, and I was interviewing with accounting firms. I was my senior year in school. And so it was, do I build bikes or do I push a pen? You know, it's.
So you were in suits looking for jobs. Did you like wear ties and stuff?
I had one suit. Yeah. My parents helped me buy a suit so that I could interview.
I have never seen you in anything but a t-shirt or a jacket.
I have not owned a suit in probably 15 years, maybe longer.
So 175.
I think I wore a suit when I got married. I've been married for 30 years. So
that would be me too. So for most people, 175 bikes doesn't sound like a lot. But if you're a frame builder, even a really good one, well-known, blah, 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 if you're not a liar and you said you made 175 frames in 1 year, you would be like at the scale of Tom Ritchie. Tom Ritchie was one of the most prolific frame builders I've ever met. And he fudged a little bit when he talked about his numbers in the early days as well. I won't tell you by how much, but 175, that's no small deal. So how in the hell does somebody that's still in college, that's working out of a friend's garage, that has a name and no money, make 175? I mean, how did you organize that?
Well, I had a professor that was my thesis professor, and he was head of the accounting department. And I told him about this. He was a cyclist, and I told him about this opportunity and what was going on, and didn't know really know what to do. And he said, "You can always be an accountant." And he was writing a new textbook, and offered to give me $15,000, the first proceeds from that book, to help get this going. And then Mark, his boss at the aerospace company, Larry Richmond, who's still part of Pivot today, he was interested in funding that from Mark's side as well. So he put $15,000 in, and I hadn't graduated yet, but it was enough for us to be able to lease a little, I don't know, 900,000 square foot bay in an industrial park up the street from Arizona State University. And then Mark had welders that were titanium welders that weren't in his testing lab that were swing shift production welders at Allied Signal. And they were always happy to make an extra buck. So we bought a manual mill. We bought a manual lathe. Larry was really good at designing fixtures. I learned a lot about how you hold titanium and order of operations and basically how to weld things from those aerospace guys. And we had a swing shift welder, and yeah, we kicked it off with a bang and got those bikes done.
If somebody gave me $30,000 when I was at the peak of my Mantis production, I would have been scared that I wouldn't have been able to pay it back. I'd be worried every minute while I was making those bicycles. So did you go free and clear? You got the money and paid it back? How'd that work out? Your first,
you know, Hal did not want a loan. He wanted to give me the money, and I did not want to just take the money. And even when we started building bikes on a more production basis, he was a road rider, and he bought several custom road bikes from us over the years, but he would never let me give him a bike. And then when Titus ended, and we started Pivot, I actually gave him stock in Pivot from the beginning, because he just kind of wanted to make it right. He's no longer with us, and since then his wife is no longer with us, so his wife's brothers and sisters will at some point get the benefit of this. But yeah, it was, he was, I wouldn't be where I am today without his investment and belief in what I'm doing here. So
that's pretty spectacular. I did a little research behind your back, and I think you're probably one of the most honest businessmen I've ever met in the bicycle industry. I mean, if you tipped the entire bicycle industry on its side and gave it a light tap, millions of flakes would drift off into nowhere. It's just not an easy business to make money at. And there's even people with goodwill have been forced into situations where they've had to abandon their, you know, the trusted investors and stuff. And one of the things that you've carried forward is you say what you're going to do, do what you're going to say, and pay your bills. And I've been in tight situations, and as a businessman that tried to get started and made a living making bikes and I know that's not an easy road. So I'd say, you know, that's probably one of the reasons that our friendship has gone so long, because most of the people that I hold close to me, and that's just a handful, are honest and trustworthy. And that's one of the reasons that I think I've just treasured your friendship all this time, is because you keep your secrets and you say what you're going to do and do what you're going to say. And that's, to me, is one of the core values of, that all humans should have. And I aspire to. I have not quite come close to your level.
Well, thank you. I try my best.
So now you delivered those bikes. Did you get another order? How did Titus get started making bikes after that? Did you just...
Well, we were making Titus bikes. We weren't marketing Titus bikes, but we delivered those bikes to Univega. Univega had a lot of other things going on, in that they kind of wanted to be a high-end brand and compete against Specialized at the time, who was really pushing the Innovator Die slogan. And GT was coming along, and there was a lot of things happening, and putting paint jobs on open mold frames from Asia wasn't a long-term plan for success. And so Univega made a minor effort at that, but they didn't really have the engineering, the backing, the things they needed behind them. So yeah, that was kind of a one and done project. But by that time, we were making our own frames. During that time, the product manager at Univega that I was working with got fed up with Univega and left and became production manager at Amp Research. And he invited me to come over there and see them. And I got to meet Horst Leitner and basically learn about the Horst Link and take a rear triangle back with me. And so we built our first Titus full suspension in 1990 with an Amp Research rear triangle. And this, when you mentioned Moab and destination stuff, people say, we go there and they're like, do you remember when we used to ride this on a hardtail? And I say, no, I took my first prototype suspension bike here. So I've never ridden Moab on a hardtail. That experience, and then where it went from there, I was pretty early proponent of suspension bikes.
Well, the Univega was a suspension bike, but a bit of a nightmare. I think it had a torsion, a second bottom bracket size torsion device in there that had rubber in it. And
yeah, it looked like a side view when you took the caps off. It looked like a revolver.
Yeah, it just, if you're going to be given a first project, and you actually had to make that work, right? Because it was just a design when you got it.
It was an idea, a rough idea. And yeah, we had to do a lot to get it to function correctly.
It was called Shock Block?
Yes, it was called the Univega Shock Block something or other. Had a number behind it.
Google that and look at the Shock Block and say, oh, I can make that work. It was two suspension systems on the same rear end, and everything had to be right for it to do anything at all. And yeah, it actually had some lifespan to it.
A little bit. Back then, RockShox was actually being made at Diacomp Cane Creek, USA. So back now where all the Cane Creek suspension is being made, that production line today is the same production line that the RS1 was made on. And because John had sold that patent to them, we had access to the cutting edge suspension technology of the time.
The ball bearing.
Yes, you filled up your fork or your rear shock in this case with a basketball pump yeah. needle. But it was basically a mini RS1, had a little rebound damper knob on the end of it. And, it, in many ways, it was the first trunnion shock,
yeah,
because it mounted on the side of the body. And but yeah, you would preload the torsion, so that provided 85-90% of the spring weight, and then you'd basically be running like 75 psi in this rear shock to kind of finish it off and give you a little damping. Idea was cool, really hard to set up for the end consumer. And I mean, it was a super high pivot bike too. So the challenges that come with that and the drivetrains and derailleurs' ability to handle all of that back then was, none of it really worked well together.
It looked cool though. Yeah. I'll admit it looked cool. I actually Googled it myself and I remember, oh, I know that bike. And now I know who made it. But anyway, back to this. So now Titus is making suspension bikes. Horst, I'm a reasonably good friend with Horst. I mean, I've known him since he started making the bikes as well. He's a brilliant man. But his philosophy is you make it so light that it breaks. And then you fix what broke. And that's the best way to arrive at the lightest possible structure. And that's what his bikes were. And unfortunately, if you were a heavy person, you kind of blew the whole equation.
Yeah.
Because they were quite flexible. At the time, I think I weighed 145. So I was the perfect person for horse bikes. His amps were not too flexible for me. But for you, I imagine that was a different story.
Yeah, my lightest fighting weight, I think, was about 180.
So I understand you had a little argument with those guys.
Well, I brought it back. It was flexy. Didn't like some things about it. Designed some fixtures it wasn't entirely straight. Designed our own like weld fixtures for it. Added some bosses so we could put a stiffening brace on the back end, and brought the fixtures back to Horst so that we could buy rear triangles and they could build them the way we wanted. And yeah, he got a little mad at me at the time and said, we're not trying to build 500 bikes. We're building 5,000 bikes. And yeah, the guy that left Univega, his name was also Richard. And he kind of separated us and Horst's daughter as well, I think, got a little involved. And we got it all worked out. And they built rear triangles for us for a couple of years because at that time we just did titanium and steel. And that was another thing, welding aluminum and heat treating aluminum. And that was a learning curve that we had yet to experience. And so that was kind of the next stage.
So Titus's first frames were dual suspension then.
No, the first frames were hardtails, and then we added that one pretty quickly.
So. Okay, because at that time, I think titanium hardtails were like the thing to have.
Yes.
Now, if your hair is gray, then your metal's probably gray. It's just it's a niche market for people that have been in the sport for a long time and don't want a dual suspension bike or a dual suspension bike with lots of travel. You know, I don't like bikes with too many muscles. But back then, I think the titanium hardtail was just, you know, on the altar.
Yeah.
It was, So you started, were your bikes the most expensive you could buy? Were they the same price as Merlin's?
They were actually a little bit better priced than Merlin's. Our goal and the way we designed our flexible manufacturing was to be able to build fully custom bikes at the volume and price of what Lightspeed was building bikes at. So we competed well at those price points, but just our volumes were super small. And we didn't have a line of, at that point yet, of standard size bikes. Everything was custom. So there would be a fit sheet, a CAD drawing, every frame that went into the shop, whether it be a suspension bike or a hardtail, was 100% built for you.
So when was the moment that you were, you know, you're working at Titus? I imagine in my mind you were, because you're so anal retentive when it comes to stuff, you're probably involved at every step from materials coming in to sales going out just to make sure it was right.
I mean, there was like five of us. So yeah, I was involved in everything.
So at what point do you think you could call it a bicycle company, a manufacturer, even a small manufacturing company? When did you arrive at that point?
Probably 92, 93. I mean, by 93, that's when I got married. And I wasn't taking home a paycheck. I was still managing, the weekend manager at the bike shops and going at nights to build bikes per piecework to try and make enough money to keep the lights on. But as far as starting to get known, building stuff, not just for Titus, but doing OEM work for other manufacturers, probably about 1993.
That's when I started Mountain Bike Action, when I sold Mantis and started working in Mountain Bike Action. I think it was 93, 94. And one of the reasons I sold Mantis was because I didn't think, I was at that point, I had five employees, including myself, and I didn't think I could run a business without being able and be creative at the same time, because I wasn't a good businessman, but I knew how to make bikes. And my wife at the time was doing the import-export. By that time, we were doing import-export to Europe and Japan, and it was going pretty well. We had line of credit, where they hand you a credit card and you said, hey, you can spend $85,000 on this credit card, and you look at your, how many bicycles you're cranking out, and you're going, $85,000, shall we just roll the dice,
Yeah.
So it was dicey, but we were doing it. That's when I could say everything was going really well. And I was designing bicycles around for Nishiki and Raleigh. I was doing custom racing bicycles under different brands for people's racing programs. But I could see it in the future. And I thought that Specialized and those people, when they stopped pretending that they were custom bike people, they were all trying to sell the high end, they would start making the custom hardware, ordering the special bearings, the things that a small company, it was out of our reach because we didn't have the scale. And I envisioned me scrambling to organize all these puzzle pieces that were in the air and losing track of the creative, the riding part and understanding the sport. And I thought, this is probably a good time to jump ship. And Zapata Espinoza got an offer he couldn't refuse from Bicycling Magazine, because Rodale, I'll say this because it's true, Rodale has just sucked when it came to the mountain bike. First, they tried to name the sport. They were like the sweater over the collar management, and they just didn't get mountain biking. And they tried to get in from the outside, from the top down, and they just failed over and over again. So they hired Zap, because Zap was authentic, and it still is to this day, and to save their, to build a mountain bike magazine around them. And that left a vacuum. And they asked me if I could come up with three or four people that might be a candidate to take his place. And my wife at the time says, you've been circling the drain on selling Mantis. Why don't you just do that? It's totally different. And I thought, what the hell? So here we are,
Yeah.
I'm no longer a bike guy. Nice. I'm no longer a bike guy. And Titus is now a functioning business. And we start there, So now I'm riding your bikes.
Yeah.
I'm getting paid to ride your bikes. That was a tough job. Tell lies and ride bikes. That's what a journalist does in that business, but not really lies. So anyway, so now what was your product line at that particular point? What did your product line look like? Were you just
doing one road bike, the full custom racer, FCR, really innovative names, by the way. We had the SFS, the standard full suspension.
Ooh. This is the accountant speaking.
Yeah. And, yeah, nobody accused me of being a brilliant marketer. and then we had a full custom racer road frame. So we had three products. And later on, when we started making our own rear triangles, we had a model called the Cyborg that was an interrupted C-tube version of the strut bike. So it was just a shorter rear end with the shock underneath the seat tower. And those were... That was the first products.
So the Racer X, Is that the first big hit that you made?
Yeah, well, the SFS became renamed as the Racer X once we started making our own rear triangles. And so a lot of times people will see the old Amp Research rear-ended bikes with the brace on them and refer to that as a Racer X. But it was actually when we started doing all of our own aluminum work. And at that time, we also started selling those rear triangles to other companies as well. So just like Amp was doing, they were doing less of that. And so we started doing a lot more of that.
Well, if I can remember right, when your rear triangles were pretty highly engineered, I think you're using rectangular tubing by then.
The first ones were oval, but everything was bigger.
Yeah.
A lot bigger than what was going on the Amp Research back end.
And the when did the swing link, that little when you added the swing link to the McPherson strut style?
Yeah, that was the second generation of the Racer X. We realized we couldn't lean the strut over anymore, and we wanted more travel out of that design. And we were already doing bikes like the Quasimoto that were linkage bikes. And so getting more stiffness and being able to take some load off those shocks. Fox at that time just was starting to get, they weren't as happy doing all these custom eyelets and everything for the struts, and basically trying to get it to where we could do eyelets on both ends of the shock. But the first ones with the guide were still basically guided strut bikes because the shock was still rigidly mounted to those.
Yeah, that's how I started out. That for people that are listening, the McPherson strut was exactly what's on the side of most cars. It's basically a wishbone, and the shock is actually a sliding member of the wishbone. It doesn't have an eyelet on both sides. And the suspension guys hated that because they were all coming from the motorcycle world where the shock had to be completely isolated from any lateral stress or movement, so that it was just being compressed as if it was a free body in space. And if you asked them to make it any stronger, they would just say, no, we can't do that. Shocks don't work that way. So it was a difficult road to perfect. And what Chris did basically was put a small linkage in there to carry all the lateral loads, which allowed you to run an eyelet on both sides and to make the shock guys really happy. And from then on, that was the prototype of, you know, almost every suspension system we use. So the McPherson strut died a happy death.
Yep.
And everybody else that was running the horse link suspension was using some sort of linkage after that point. Specialized, even Horst. All of his B4s and B5s had a link in them.
Yeah, and Intense was coming along during that time, and they had all their four bar stuff with a lot of holes, a lot of positions to mount your shock. Yeah. To the point that it wasn't like, was there a good position?
The Carpiel.
Yeah,
there's everything had an adjustment on a Carpiel, so he didn't have any responsibility for making the system work. It was just all on you.
We were all trying to figure it out too a little bit. So finding stuff that worked and trying to get to the point where if you gave multiple positions to mount the shock, they better all be worth it. Like there should be some redeeming value of every position and not one that completely jacks the bike.
Well, both of us raced motorcycles or rode motorcycles at different times, and I think Jody Weisel, the editor of Motocross Action, in his voice, I'll say it. Yeah, they come with 35 adjustments, but only one is right. And it's true.
That was true. That was certainly true back then.
Yeah, the motorcycles, no matter how many adjustments you put on them, there's just three clicks that were right on everything. So it was easy. Let's go back to the Racer X, because I was a proponent of dual suspension trail bikes from the beginning. In fact, I had a pretty popular one with the max strut on it, and they all worked really well as long as they had about 50 millimeters of rear wheel travel. They felt a lot like a hardtail because when you're really pushing them out of the saddle, even the minimal travel forks back then, the RockShox RS1, I think it had what, 45 millimeters of travel,
yeah, or something like that. Yeah.
So when you leaned over the front with those 130 millimeter stems we had, there was only a half an inch of travel. So it wasn't like the things were pogoing up and down. You just basically mashed the suspension down to its maximum stiffness and accelerated out of the corners. And that's how most of the early dual suspension, popular dual suspension bikes were. And the Racer X was similar to that. It was like super fast to ride as a suspension bike at a time when most people thought hardtails were the gold standard for efficiency. It didn't feel much difference. It was a stiff, fast, just easy to ride bike. But later on, you came out with, was the Quasimodo was your downhill bike?
Yep.
That was a interrupted seat tube. That means that it had a subframe on it. And we didn't have dropper posts back then, so we didn't need a long seat tube. But anyway, it was a radical bike for the time, because that's when you look at a bike and you say, where do all the hard points have to be on a dual suspension bike? And they're not. They don't line up with a standard dual double diamond frame like the Racer X and most of the early designs were look like a regular double diamond bicycle frame with hinges on them. And that was easy to digest for people that didn't think suspension was ever going to sell or were riding their first suspension bike. But there's the Quasimodo that just looked like a modern downhill bike,
yeah,
with a steep head angle,
steeper than
and a high bottom brackets, because we thought, you know, everybody rode on the South Mountain. There's big rocks and boulders everywhere, but it turns out that most of the bike park these days don't have any rocks in them except for where they place them, so they could have zero clearance bottom brackets. But back to this, when you came out with a Quasimodo, you came out with a couple of bikes that had long travel, and by long I'm saying 4 inches.
Yeah, so the Moto Lite was actually 125 millimeter travel, so 5.
That's just outrageous for the time.
Yeah, so it was either a 4.5 or 5 inches, and that one, that was cool because it was lighter. It wasn't a bolt-on C tower. We didn't really. I think Intense was starting, and Foes was really the only one who had hydroforming. Oh, and Mountain Cycle had hydroforming down to some extent, and we didn't know that technology yet here. So, and there was no CAD. So literally we were blacksmithing this seat tower and then getting it all built on the bike, built a couple prototypes, blacksmithing some more, and then having to hammer it back out flat to see what we had done and how we had arrived here. And now how are we going to build this thing in steps? And that's actually how I met Bill Kibler, our current R&D production manager. He was working at a high-end ATV race shop that had a bunch of press brakes and everything, and he figured out how to make that part.
If anybody doesn't know Bill, Bill's the CNC god that has been with Chris for how many years now?
Well, that was 97, 98, where I met him and started working with him on a project, and then in his... And then he pursued us as far as when he owned his own machine shop of can we do work for Titus? And so, yeah, he's been, I've known him since, I don't know, mid-90s. And yeah, we've worked together for a long time.
So when you sent me, I think, what was the model that you sent Mountain Bike Action, the long travel one? I think it was the Moto Lite.
Yeah.
The original one.
Yes.
And then later on, you sent successive ones, you know, as I warmed up to what I thought long travel suspension was.
The original Moto Lite did well, but the second generation was more of a double diamond triangle. Looked like the Racer X, but with a functional full linkage on it. But they were both, I don't think that bike ever got over 5 inches of travel. It was always between 4.5 and 5 with 2 travel settings on the linkage.
That seems to be a sweet spot even today.
It is.
I mean, it's 4 inches of travel, 5 inches of travel, somewhere around there anymore. And it seems to complicate the design. Like it adds weight.
Yeah.
To the design to increase the travel because you have clearances and longer levers and stuff, but the magic for performance, lightweight, and versatility seems to be somewhere between 4 and 5 inches.
Yeah, that's kind of a great all around. Well, now cross country race bike number.
100 millimeters for cross country. You would have ever guessed. Yeah. But I mean, back then you were breaking some serious ground because there wasn't much. Like, I think there was a Fox ALS. Was that? It was Fox.
The Fox Alps.
ALPS. That was it.
Yeah.
That was that one wasn't the greatest damper in the world. I think for the top of the downhills, it was a shock. At the bottom of the downhills, it was a shock-like mechanism. And that was one of the best lightweight dampers you could buy at the time.
Yeah, and it was, even compared to the size of today's shocks, it was the diameter, the body and the sealing section was relatively huge.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about a strut bike that's running really low leverage ratio, really low pressures, there's monster seal stiction. It was, you know, you got efficiency because of seal stiction, and because that suspension wasn't moving till you hit something. And yeah, the switch from trying that first amper end with an amp coil, which was also an interesting shock. It was not the best of suspension components, to that Alps being a real damped first air shock, but no negative pressure chambers, no negative springs, all that pressure shoved against a huge seal, and even greases, oils, all the things that none of the stuff existed. There's no Kashima coating yet.
What was the first? It was the first pedal friendly shock, because as long as you pedal lightly, it refused to move until you overcame the seal stiction. So it was ahead of its time in the worst possible way. But yeah, you're right. There's no negative spring in it. So whatever you pressurized the shock at was what the ending pressure was. And it wasn't like sticking a coil on a table. Like, a coil spring goes to zero at the end of its spring rate. But an air shock goes to whatever you set it at. And I think it was at a time when everybody was worried about flats, 45 PSI in your tires was common for some of the cross country guys.
45 to 50 PSI.
Yeah, to keep from getting flats.
Yeah.
And then they were putting as much pressure as they could possibly stick in the shock, so it didn't work unless they hit something really big. So the potential for the best suspension design in the world to not work was really high at that time. But you are actually, I think, as far as your long travel bikes at the time, I'm not sure what year that was, but I remember that it was the first crack at an enduro bike before anybody was even thinking of what enduro would be. A truly long travel bike that was light enough that you could take into the backcountry and really do some crazy stuff. And it was right outside of my understanding when I first started riding those bikes. Like, what am I going to do with that? But I lived in an area where we rode on flat fire roads at the top of the hills, and then we bombed down trails and technical stuff on the other side. When I came out to ride with you, it all kind of fit in place, because South Mountain is like, the uphills are technical. I mean, you need suspension to really enjoy the trails in your backyard. And, you know, you schooled me a dozen times before I got it. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, you need to some space between your tires and your butt in order to negotiate this for any length of time. And then it all clicked. I'm like, oh, yeah.
And it is a little bit different here, but we'd always also go to Moab too, and that was our favorite destination. And how many times could you ride Porcupine Rim in a week? And, you know, having a 5-inch travel bike was really key to that success. And then also, as things progressed, you're going faster in big routes in Pennsylvania, and some of the things that we developed here turns out worked well in a lot of different places. And then our riding style shifted as well.
That's true. There is a suspension learning curve. You have to change your pedal circle a little bit, make a bunch of adjustments to make a dual suspension bike as efficient as it could be. Now we take it for granted. Everybody that buys a bike, unless they're really into a rigid bike, almost everybody buys a dual suspension bike and learns on it. there's no idea of what it could have been before. Most of the people grow up with the technology. Yeah. And as you would learn later, you know, with when you hooked up with the DW link and as suspension kinematics became the word of the day, we started relying less on shocks that don't work to make the bikes feel better.
Yeah.
and geometry that did work and kinematics. And that really pushed it over the top. And that's, I think you were at the forefront of dual suspension before that happened. So you were one of the first people to realize the true value of that technology because you had been working on it. I think you brought the horse link as far as it can go. I've got a horse link bike now from Germany. And I remember that in the later versions of the Tituses that I rode, they have the similar feel. It's just that beautiful performance in the mid-stroke, you know?
Yep.
It was just, it can't be beat. It's just you sacrifice something on the top and something on the bottom. But that mid-stroke performance in those bikes was just wonderful.
And yeah, when I look at, other than the fact that we've got the wrong size wheels and we ran stems that were way too long, so geometry is completely whacked. If you took the linkage off the original Motolite or Quasimoto and plopped them on a modern bike, as far as the suspension curves and rates, there wouldn't be much to change. What was right back then is still right today.
That's true. If you look where the virtual pivot locations are and everything, it's kind of like what was right. Bob Gervins, who brought one of the first rear suspension bikes in, he was a car racer, and he knew about all the different acceleration angles and stuff from racing modified stock cars up in the Northeast. And so his little single pivot bike with a location right above the middle chain ring that he patented for that specific reason. If you look at all the virtual pivot points and stuff today that are the most accepted, they all hover around Bob Gervin's fixed pivot.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, here's a guy who came out of cars, didn't know shit about bikes. And he said, this is where it has to be. And you're like, it took us 22 years to agree with him.
Yeah, it took a while to get up the pivots up to those key locations. And even back then, there was a lot of single high pivots, but they were really high pivots.
Yeah, it had to be in the right spot. He called me one time and asked me about that. How'd you get to that spot? I said, I don't know. Maybe I just
cleared the front derailleur mount much.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get back to something that is one of my favorite subjects. And that is, how the hell did a guy went who rides motorcycles, who's totally into dual suspension, heavy duty, one of the best technical riders I know. How did you fall in love with road bikes so much and hardtails that you could come up with that, the most expensive frame to build in the world? And I'm talking about the ExoGrid system. So basically, the ExoGrid system is you take a beautiful titanium frame. And I think Titus was the only company I've ever seen use this technology. Then you laser cut a pattern out of the tube. Then you use that pattern to capture a molded carbon fiber liner inside the titanium tube. And then you leave the ends just long enough so that you can, I'm pretty sure you guys use heat sinks because there's no other way. Yeah. You put a heat sink on the thing and then weld it, TIG weld it in it the same way you'd TIG weld it, a standard titanium frame. And I rode those bikes and they had a distinct feel. They were just beautiful hardtails, you know, but they had a distinct feel that, you know, you think you're imagining, but when you ride another bike, another titanium bike or steel or aluminum or whatever, it just doesn't feel that way. But I think you even admitted that there's probably no more expensive way to build a frame. How did you end up towards the end of the Titus era, making a bike like that?
Well, when things were, we were seeing things go towards carbon fiber and just kind of like before I knew about brazing or before I knew about titanium or aluminum. You just got to find a way to learn this technology. And the opportunity came to merge Titus with Viatech, which was a composites technology company. And so my goal at the time was that this would be good for us. It would be a good venture and we would gain all this aerospace technology that nobody else had. That turned out to be not quite right, but that's not how it baked out. But the idea was to get that carbon fiber composite knowledge. And they came to the table. One of the patents they held was something called IsoGrid. And it was basically a normal carbon tube, but you could make the tube thinner and then there would be a reinforcement structure inside of basically a weave of Kevlar strips inside that would reinforce this really thin wall tube from buckling. It actually didn't have as much of a good application in the bike business. Like if you were racing America's Cup and you had mast poles the size of, you know, that were 3 feet wide, that's where that technology really would benefit most. When you brought it down to a bike tube size, it didn't have as much benefit, but we were still making these carbon fiber tubes really thin, certainly too thin for mountain biking. And this is where I met Kevin. He came in as a composites consultant to help us with some things, because we actually didn't get a lot of technology transfer over from Viatech and had to learn a lot of stuff on our own. And Kevin, who's a founder of Pivot and has been with me since the early days of that Viatech Titus partnership, he had owned a snowboard company, was involved in composites, and came in as a consultant. And we developed all these different layups of IsoGrid tubes, and I would build road bike frames with just different layup down tubes. And so we do on the computer what it would tell us as far as changing bending stiffness and torsional stiffness. And then we'd build another tube and then we'd build another lugged bike with it. And so it was easiest to do it on the road bike. You could really see what was going on. You could feel the bottom bracket stiffness change or the chatter through the handlebars. And so we really started to get a good feel for, okay, if I change this layup, this material, and the computer says it does this, this is what it means in the real world. And so I probably had 5 or 6 frames that were identical except for layup changes on these bikes. And the rest of them were primarily titanium. And then I was riding down South Mountain on the road, and I got a little wiggle and I looked down at the top tube and the carbon fiber in the lug where the paint was and stuff, it started gapping on me. I just heard a little pop over a expansion joint. And got on the brakes. The front end of the bike did not come off, but it scared the piss out of me. And I was like, Kevin, you know, the whole thing about how we have to prep the titanium and we're molding these things blind, and we're totally relying on this glue. And did we prep the titanium perfect? Did too much heat get into the bond area? We could have a problem here. And at the time we were doing it and I still did not trust composites. I was still a metal guy. And so I was like, I don't feel even comfortable riding bikes like where this could happen. And I said, you know, what about if we had a mechanical lock? We could make the lugs look like a Colnago and cut some diamonds in it and then mold the carbon so it pushed up through those holes. And then even if, yeah, a bond might break, but that tube's not coming apart. And so we did that and it was successful. But then rocks hitting the carbon fiber tube on the bottom of a racer X. We were at the time using a 1¾ down tube. And when you got to 1¾ titanium, that was a rolled and seamed tube. The wall thickness was a little heavier. It was quite the baseball bat. And so now you're taking a titanium frame and making it quite a bit heavier. and you're gaining stiffness that you need, but it, you're gaining it in all directions. So some of the ride quality that you had out of titanium is now gone. And so then I was like, well, let's, what if we did this whole thing in diamonds and just gutted it? And so we still rocks hitting it and stuff. We'd have titanium, and titanium still bends nice. And then you don't have to worry about the carbon fiber and doing the layup so that we're getting strength from the carbon fiber. We really can just tune with the carbon fiber. And so by the time we were done, we had tube sets that had bending stiffness that were more compliant than titanium, but torsional bottom bracket head tube stiffness that were way higher than aluminum bikes at the time. And so you could really build a really kick-ass chassis out of it, but it was a labor-intensive process. That tube would get laser cut in an oxygen-free atmosphere, have all kinds of slag inside. Then it would go to an aerospace deburr shop. Rows of people with little dental grinders cleaning up all the edges of every T on every logo, every diamond, and there's hundreds of diamonds. And then it would have a like a flapper wheel deburring on the inside to get the surface finish perfect for molding carbon fiber inside. And then we basically lay up the carbon fiber tubes on a mandrel as we do today, slip it inside, and it would fill the area. And then we would stack 10 to 15 stacks of diamonds and Titus logos and carbon fiber in those open holes.
Sounds like a nightmare.
And then we'd put it in the mold, do the deal, come out with a tube. But those tubes, because they were because they were seamed tubes, not drawn tubes, they weren't super round to begin with. So now all the resin, you couldn't look at it and see it wasn't round, but if you tried to spin it on the lathe, the thing's popping all over the place. So you can't really clean it up easy. So then we had to have all these tubes centerless ground. And so a down tube on a Racer X, before we coped it, welded it, did anything at the time, was around $450 is what I had into it.
Oh my God.
And weeks of process to get it to that point. So yeah, somehow or another, we made money off these bikes, and it was a good, cool thing. And we learned a ton. And they do look beautiful, but the juice isn't always worth the squeeze.
I guess. To me, that sounds like the diversion. Like you could have probably reinvented the entire dual suspension bike in the amount of time it took to figure out the process. They're beautiful. I mean, there's probably Racer X's and road bikes that you've made that are hanging in museums now that people just want to pet because they're that beautiful.
And we still see it. We built a surprising number of those bikes. A surprising number of people bit the bullet and spent the money, and they were all custom. And we see them at Nike races. They're out there and they're running, and they will probably never break.
Do you think your bottom brackets are still around somewhere?
I don't think anybody would be running 2-degree taper spindles anymore. That would there's probably a couple out there, but I think that one went a long time ago.
Okay, so that was a diversion, but I wanted to hear that story because every time I saw those things, I thought, these are so beautiful, but why would anybody want to put that much money into a bike frame, you know? And that just to have the same similar bike frame. They rode beautifully, but every time I saw as a builder, you know, as somebody that builds things, I just thought, can you make it harder on yourself?
Yeah, you can just imagine Kevin and I doing the first ones. And after we get the laser all cut out and get this piece of crap tube back, we're sitting back there with the little pencil grinders, sweating, and just like hours to make the first tube to see if this even's going to be a thing. And then having to figure out a process where we could actually make batches of tubes and get all the vendors lined up and find people that could get us past the next challenge on that. And we had it humming. It was great.
Well, Kevin, talking about Kevin, you met Bill, Kevin. I mean, you assembled a group of people when you were with Titus.
Yeah.
Many of them, investors and designers and stuff still are with you today, or would be with you if they were still alive. When was the point at Titus? And you know, you're a hands-on guy. You're like type A. Everything has to be right. You're the personality that would overmanage if in my imagination would overmanage everything, but you don't. In my experience, the people that work for you and your vendors and stuff, I mean, you push them really hard, but you allow them to do their job and, you know, kind of hands off. Once you get into agreement, you know, they're free to do what they do. I mean, Kevin works remotely and he's been with you for how many years?
Well, since the beginning of Pivot, and 5 years before that.
And Bill, how long has he been with you?
Again, he sold his machine shop. Actually, us being together in the same company was the beginning of Pivot, but he was a very close vendor and became our primary vendor for all machine parts and aluminum parts probably 6 years before we started Pivot as well.
Yeah, he dates back pretty far. So what was the point where you either were forced to or chose to, because I mean, when you were at Titus, you also started off, you started sending some of your excess production out, farming that out. So that's, I mean, basically, I think you ended up in Taiwan.
Yep.
While you were at Titus. It started first in using USA vendors, something that didn't work out too well for me. I went through a few until I found some people that were really solid. But then you went to Asia, and I was designing and managing products in Asia all the way up to 93. And that's a different world. So how did you... You can't possibly manage Titus at home and be in Taiwan and running that. So how did you make the transition?
Well,
because for somebody like you to be in Taiwan and be absolutely happy that your business is running perfect here, you'd have to entrust it to some pretty good people.
Yeah, I mean, by that time at Titus, I mean, originally I was the production manager. I coked all the tubes. But, you know, at the beginning, you're everything. And I do have, it's always a learning process of trying to be willing to give something up. And back then, I didn't have the money always to hire people that could do it better. So I kept a lot of things probably too tight. And then tried to train what I could, but by the time, I mean, from the aerospace side, some of these welders that we got, and we had good people on the welding side. I had trained somebody up on the production management side, that was doing a great job. And I actually still did every one of the custom drawings for every customer and on every bike until the day I left.
Really?
Yeah.
So you were the chief engineer?
Yeah.
Did you do all the creative, or did you use a collaboration on some of the creative stuff?
When you say creative?
Like when you came up with a Quasimodo, was that like in your mind, this is how I want it?
Yeah.
And you drew it out?
Yeah.
And you started making it and stuff?
Back then, Cindy found a box of old Titus t-shirts the other day. And they all look like somebody kind of hand drew some of the logos and the bikes on the t-shirts with a crayon, because I did.
You were the marketing guy too.
Yeah. So I'd hand draw a lot of the stuff, and yeah, we went with that. But by the Quasimodo time, I mean, I met another guy that was industrial designer, and, some of the machine parts and things. I didn't know 3D CAD. And that was back then. Pro E was the program for that. I knew AutoCAD, and that's, I would do it to a certain point. And then we had other people that would finish it, but I'd be behind their shoulder like, oh, no, make it like, do this, do this. And, but yeah, at some point you gotta, we got a whole room of industrial designers and mechanical engineers, and there's a concept of what the bike is going to be. And I have input, but they come up with a lot of ideas, and they sketch, and we talk, and as a group, we define where things are going as far as the look of what a pivot bike is. But yeah, every step is kind of like tearing a Band-Aid off as you go along, because if it's something you had full control over and it was going well, you know, giving that up is super difficult.
But you did. But I have seen you look at somebody else's idea and frown like, oh, that's not my idea, and then see it on the next year's bike. So somewhere in there you said, you know, that's a better idea than me, and you allowed it to happen. And that's one of the things I had a hard time giving up, you know, because I thought all my ideas were great because I was my own editor, right? But I've seen you walk through your factory, and you know, one thing that amazed me is that you know everybody there, and I'm sure it's large enough now so that you'd stutter on a few names. But back then, you knew everybody, and if somebody was doing something slightly different, you're like looking over his shoulder, and I could see you in the back of your mind, I'll let it go, and it was okay. So for you to hand off the business at Titus after making it and being hands-on, you had to at some point, because to make a bicycle in Taiwan means you got to be there for like a month at a time sometimes.
Yeah, when we started Pivot, I spent the 7 months in Taiwan. I would come home, and then there'd be something wrong, and just fly back out and go and be there. And yeah, Joel Smith, who was with Manitou and then started Tomac Bikes on its second round, he was getting ready working on Tomac at the time, and we had some of the same vendors and things, and he moved his whole family there.
Wow.
And I was living out of a hotel, same hotel, usually the same room. And they knew me well, but it was actually a thought in my mind. Oh, that's a pretty good idea, moving your family over. That my wife would never have that for a second, but we had young kids, but so did he. And so it's kind of an interesting thing on that and getting things going. And Taiwan, I had more at the beginning with Titus, certainly way more failures than successes. And the fact that we were in-house manufacturer really saved our bacon, because as these things were failing horribly and it wasn't going well over there, we were still making it.
Yeah.
And it gave hope too, that if we could do it, you can do it. You just gotta do it differently, and then also learning that same thing kind of Horst told me back then, we're not trying to make 500, we're trying to make 5,000, except now we're not trying to make 5,000, they're trying to make 50,000 or a million or whatever the numbers that those large factories that we started with were. Their numbers are so much higher in the processes, and to reset my expectations and the way me and starting to bring Bill and Kevin over with me to Asia, and us taking a look at, okay, this is our aerospace vision of production, and this is the reality of making a consumer product, and how do we bring these together so that they can build a very high quality consumer product and hold our standards in the way they're going to do things, because they can tell you can put things in place, walk out the door, and they never told you that their welders are paid per piece. And if they don't finish the front triangle in 5 minutes or whatever the time is, that it's not going to work. And the second you leave, they're going to go back to the way that they do things. And so
it's a rough deal, because you only get 75% of what you agreed on, and then you have to go back the next month and the next month. And it's a tuning process over, it takes sometimes years to evolve it with an Asian factory to where everything is just running right. It's That's what I noticed. When I went there, I thought I could do it all in one trip. And I realized, no, you just got to go back. And it's not, you're not yelling at anybody. You're just saying, let's try this and let's try that. And things got better. But you've done a good job. I mean, you look at the level that you've been able to do with Pivot, and knowing that they come out of factories, that, you know, they're building bicycles right now while we talk, and that they come out so good. It has to be that you build something here. You know, you can build them here almost as good or better than you could build them over there. But the fact that you have an operation here at Pivot and an operation going overseas, there's an understanding and a flow of information back and forth that you don't get from just trying to manage a business overseas and do all your designing here. I've seen that, and it doesn't come up with a product as good as what you do. And it is amazing that, for instance, my last Switchblade, I rode for 5 years, and I had yet to get a flat tire or any failures. I mean, there's been nothing. All the bearings are tight. Everything works. It's just an amazing thing. And at some point, I can only blame that, you know, part of that on the frame. Obviously, the frame works, the shock works.
Yeah, the flat tire thing, you can give that credit to Stans or somebody.
I'm giving that credit to somebody that has no substance on this earth. But I had to throw away my tube last month because the stem wore a hole in
it. That's a good problem to have.
Your bikes have been incredibly reliable, especially during the tightest years, because that was when everybody was trying to figure out suspension. As an editor that was testing bikes all the time, I had to bring tools every time I brought a suspension bike out, because there was the possibility that a pivot bolt was going to fall out, or, you know, if something happened on almost every bike. And the Tituses that I rode from the beginning, from the original Moto lights, you know, which were, you know, built with whatever you could source from outside the bicycle industry suppliers, because that stuff just wasn't available at the time. All of those bikes were reliable, and that comes back to you. But what I'm getting at here is that, like, Henry Ford built his entire empire on partnerships, both with his labor and his designers, his engineers and stuff. He just surrounded himself with the right people. And I think there's a funny story where he had so many patents that there was a congressional hearing that he was being barbecued by hired technical luminaries from universities, engineers and stuff that were world renowned. And he was just being peppered by all these questions. They didn't believe he was smart enough to create this production line, this factory, and crank out cars that were actually affordable and reliable. And he was losing the battle. He was getting ground down. And finally he stood up and says, look, I don't have answers to all of these professional questions. I can't answer all these questions, but if you give me 5 minutes, I can go into my factory and bring a man out who can. And that was the end of the hearing. And that's pretty much, if you look at where you started and where you ended up, you've surrounded yourself with some just awesome people. It's partners, investors. Your goodwill has, I believe, when you started Pivot, didn't you get some return on you? Some investors come forward who had been with you before?
Yeah, when we did the Viatech merger, they were also raising money from other outside investors, and some other people came in that weren't bike people at all. They were golf people, actually. And some of them became bike people during that time, and we became close. And even though the whole Viatech thing did not end positively, we remained friends, and they knew that even though they didn't want to have a bicycle company as part of the deal they were investing in, that it wound up being the shining star of the group. And we became friends, and they liked the way I did business and were willing to back what we wanted to do here.
Yeah. So you, I mean, and in your factory, you know, you've got, I think now you have engineers in Stuttgart.
We have an office in Stuttgart.
Yeah.
And, but all the engineers are still here.
Okay. But I mean, your engineers are pretty sharp. I mean, you're not obviously, you're actually shaping your products now, but you've farmed out a lot. I think in the time between Pivot and, by the time you got to Pivot, you were pretty good at searching people out that could, you know, do these tasks, maybe a little bit better, or at least as good as you.
Better. I mean, that was the thing, starting this company and being able to do things from a fresh standpoint. I started to say earlier that at Titus, aside from those small investments, when you're in college and they put the credit card offers on the table, on the desks when you come into the classrooms, like I'd take those home and I had those, you know, that was that at the beginning, that was financing my ability to build, buy tubing, sell a bike, build things in the garage. And so when you start a company that way, it is hand to mouth. And then from the people you hire, you can't just go out and hire the best people. You can't afford the best people. So you start with what you can and you get it by with what you can. But if you have a chance to blank slate and say, hey, this is my business plan. This is what we need to do this. And I can't start the new company using QuickBooks because that won't last long. Then learn that at Titus. And you need a operations manager that actually knows operations and finding good people from the get-go that were right for the organization. And yeah, that the majority of that first group of people, the first handful of employees, I think most all of them are still here other than one. And he was my business partner's nephew, and it was meant to be training wheels for him to move on to something bigger in their family businesses. So, it's worked out well with that philosophy of trying to find the best people for the role and find people that have knowledge base way beyond what I have in certain areas.
Well, I think one of the themes is from the very beginning is you've always had good partners, you know.
Not always.
Well, yeah, true. Didn't work out with Viatech. That's one bad one out of many good ones.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the invisible Chris Kokalis now. Most people who know you, most people that think about your bikes, they see the bikes that come out and all that stuff. But you've been behind the scenes. I think you started your first partnerships. Well, with AMP from the beginning, but I think you started doing evaluations and help. I think, weren't you working behind the scenes with Shimano for a while?
Yep.
And I think with most of your suppliers, you've played an invisible role, either pressuring or advising or evaluating with most of your key suppliers since the early Titus times.
Yep.
And I think that developed to a point where you were probably holding more secrets than any component manufacturer in the business, because I've had conversations when we've been rolling down the trails and stuff on bikes, and I think at one time we always talked about handling and stiffness, and it was all about frames and the performance of the bicycle. And somehow after you started going to Asia a lot of times, almost all of our conversations were like, you know, I need a little bit more space in the rear triangles for this to get the exact chain line and blah, blah, blah. And you just were sweating all these details about derailleur spacing and bottom bracket, this and that. And everything started to turn into like this talk about the technology that was coming. And it kind of dovetailed because as you, I heard from that you were actually on the Shimano's like, what do they call it? Their Skunk Works or whatever, something like
that. Yeah. Skunk Works a little different, but it was interesting after Shimano had their shifters with the, where the brake levers move,
the disaster shifters,
the flippy floppers, and the rapid rise rear derailleur and some of the technologies that came with that era. that kind of culminated in I think a long period of Shimano design, being very internal and very private. And then having it not pay off in the marketplace. So they invited me and I believe Jeff Stieber, and I forget one other guy to be on the next generation XTR development team and actually be access to engineers, be on the development team, ideas that drove what was going to happen. And that was my last year of Titus and into the first year of Pivot that I had that level of involvement and developed the PressFit 92 bottom bracket, because that is something we needed to launch Pivot the way the designs of the bikes were done. And we were going to do a internal bottom bracket with a wider BB shell, regardless of whether Shimano was on board or not. And it worked out nice.
Yeah. Cause pretty much all the key players at SRAM and Fox, Shimano, all of them have stories about the pressure that you put on them. It's always positive because you have really good ideas and specific things. I think you mentioned in your in one of your interviews that somewhere between the end of Titus and the beginning of Pivot, you realized that in order to make the bicycle the perfect bicycle that you wanted, the performance, the reliability, you're going to have to look at the bicycle and all of its components as one single unit. It was like a realization. So when about what time did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, that was really from the design of the first Pivots, and this is what we need to do this. And before we launched the company, what we wanted in the head tube size, the headset standard actually existed, but nobody was using it and Chris King wasn't supporting it. And there was a 1 year behind the scenes politicking really of, hey, okay, Shimano's on board with this PressFit thing, but it's just Shimano. We got to get SRAM and we got to get Raceface and we got to get Chris King to do a bottom bracket too. And we got all of them, and we got Chris King at the time said he would never, ever do anything but an external headset cup. And we got in about a 5-minute tiffy argument. And I was like, well, then at some point you're not going to be in the headset business anymore, because this is going to go this way. We're going to push it pretty hard. And it would help us if Chris King was like on board with this standard, because you guys would add legitimacy to what we're going to do, and we're going to do it either way. And we got him on board, and they do a lot of business in that type of headset today. And then same thing with the bottom bracket. Took a little longer on the SRAM side, but by the time, within 6 months of launching Pivot for the standards that we needed on that bicycle, we had everybody that we needed on board to do that. So that was a real standard for the time being in the marketplace.
What about the rear spacing? I know you've gone around, but you stuck your neck out pretty far on an ultra wide rear axle spacing.
Yeah, I'm the most vocal publicly about it, but Kevin was the one losing his mind. It was when Boost came out, we were struggling and we were trying to find the ability to do a long travel 29er and get the stiffness we want. The prototypes we were building had clearance problems and stiffness problems, and there just wasn't enough space for what we needed to do. And then Boost came out and we saw just how much on each side we got. And we're like, it's not nothing. It's something. But really?
1.5 millimeters on one side and 3 on the other or something like that?
Yeah.
It is pretty pathetic.
It was not great. And then we had done all this work on the fat bike. And the big thing on the fat bike was that rear triangles were either 197 wide or 177. And if you were a fat bike racer, you had to run 177 because you couldn't really pedal the cranks at race speeds when you had the Q factor of a 197 crank. And then, but if you had a 177 rear end, you couldn't run 5-inch tires, so you couldn't run in soft snow.
So it's the
and
same
being thing. With all the snow we have here in Phoenix, it's a real problem that we had to contend with.
So it's the same deal with 29ers, because your involvement with component makers actually just preceded the explosion of standards and wheel sizes that kind of overlapped Titus and Pivot. That was the big argument during that period of time. And when you try to stuff the same size tire and a larger wheel and keep the chainstays at some correct length, you run into a whole bunch of problems up by the crank set, where a change in spacing of the rear axle gives you, and a little bit of the bottom bracket. I mean, these little tiny changes could actually allow you to run a reasonably wide tire on a 29er, which wasn't possible when it first came out. I mean, they were calling them 2.25 or 2.27 tires, but they were, if you measured them, they were like barely 2 inches wide, and they were still rubbing the frames and collecting mud down there.
Yeah. And it was just it was a shit show. We discovered when we were still running front derailleurs, just how much we could move the chainring out towards the crank arm on the fat bikes and still have a front derailleur not collide into the crank arm. And it was pretty substantial. I don't remember the exact number, but it allowed us, with room to spare, to do a custom chainring offset and put the cranks for a 177 rear end on a 197 rear end bike and have the chain line be correct. And it was way more aggressive of a movement than what Super Boost became. And 157 already existed, and it gave us...
It was a downhill standard, right?
Yeah, it gave us everything we needed from a spacing standpoint. And then we looked at all the downhill hubs. We built the first prototype bikes with downhill hubs. The whole idea behind downhill hubs was even spoke tension for 26-inch wheels. Yep. So you got these ultra-narrow hub flanges, which now you put on a 29-inch wheel, and the rim, unless you were running like a really heavy-duty Envy 29-inch carbon rim at the time, you just didn't have wheel stiffness.
Yeah, that really sucked in the early days. The moment, the extra moment on the larger diameter wheels with a tire on them, just it felt like everything was wiggling back there. So it overextended the stiffness of the suspension rear ends and everything, really.
Yeah, and so we thought we had a good opportunity also on the wheel side to make pretty substantial improvements with where things were today, and on the clearance side of things, and not affect Q factor, because people were just like, that was the immediate thing. Oh, our cranks are going to get wide like a fat bike. But we designed it to run a 168 Q factor, which was the cross-country-ish standard. Pretty much every trail bike crank is like 174 or 178 to 184 now. So we were able to achieve all of those things. And so it's interesting today when you see what's happened, because Boost obviously was supported by the largest of manufacturers. We use it on our cross country bikes. It still has it's got a solid following that's not going away. But now all the drivetrain manufacturers have had to move their chainring standard out, their chain line, to 55, which is right about where it was moved for Super Boost. But now the chain's got a cross chain to hit where the cog is on a 148 rear end. And so they've made better chain rings. They've made chains that can cross chain, and they've made it work.
Yeah. A lot of effort went into forcing the standard chain lines to go across 12 cogs that could have been solved by just making a wider rear end and putting the cassette in the middle of the chain line.
Yeah. And so there's been improvements made with like XX and stuff, you know, things being moved by a millimeter or two here. I mean, the Super Boost standard is 56.5. Now the chain line's 55. They used up some of the space to move their cassette out a little bit.
Yeah.
And now, yeah, works okay. But is it perfect? What was it as perfect as it could have been? I still think 157 buys you more opportunity, but either way, they both work slightly differently. And
well,
we want to build a better bike.
You force the industry to look at a better solution. And if they don't want to adopt the better solution, then they had to move everything. They had to cheat it out anyway.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, showing them the way, they didn't agree with you, but at least they've moved everything to where you wanted it.
Well, a handful of companies did agree, and we work very closely with SRAM. They were not happy. Obviously, they put a lot of money behind Boost. That them and Trek were that was their thing, and then to somebody to come and kind of make fun of it and call it Super Boost. It was meant to be a joke.
It was.
We should be laugh at ourselves about the whole thing. And then, yeah, it just, at the time, they were angry enough that they, even though we had a relationship, they basically said they would never do that for us. And we became big enough, and other people asked us about Super Boost, and there's a handful of good high-end companies that run 157 spacing now, and SRAM makes cranks, and they're actually labeled Super Boost, which was, ooh. I didn't think they would do that. When we finally got through everything and the first samples came and the spindles were laser etched Super Boost, I got a chuckle out of that. And yeah, it's just, it's a good option for longer travel trail bikes. And I mean, even downhill bikes now, because you can bring that Q factor back in on the downhill bikes and go the other direction. So, but yeah, we'll continue to do that kind of stuff, because you can't just leave all these parts on the bicycle stuck in time and expect the bicycle to advance.
That is the biggest understatement you've ever said.
I have, but people expect that. They expect nothing to ever change, but somehow miraculously, like, my same axles, my same wheels, my same everything's got to always fit on this bike. But somehow this bike over time has to get better.
Imagine if we still had the same standards on motorcycles that were in the 30s and 40s. Just no way. I mean, the whole reason that Harley Davidson are 45 degree V is because that's the only way they could put two cylinders inside of a bicycle frame. And it had a cool sound. So it's patented today.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've got a number of my early bicycles hanging from the rafters and nothing except for the pedals. I think the pedals and the hand grips. What else? And the saddle will fit a modern bike. Wheel sizes, the spacing, everything. Everything's changed, and for the good. I mean, when somebody buys a bike today, they don't have to think about what components are on it. And I think a lot of that goes back to people like you that have been in behind the scenes, especially during that, the wheel changes, the disc brake standards, the diameters, that all the things, internal cable routing that didn't require a physicist and a magician to operate, all the things that have made these bicycles so reliable, easy to work on, all that stuff was resisted by bike shop mechanics and industry idiots like myself. I mean, I've resisted stuff that I thought would never work, and it turned out that it was way better.
Well, I mean, that's human nature, and I do the same thing. And there's certain things that we kind of maybe missed the boat on and then figured out the best way to do it. And yeah, I mean, there's a big debate now. Should cables run through headsets? And today my stance is that's silly.
Why would you create a problem that doesn't really need, except that looks really good?
Well, and people are passionate about their bikes and the way their bikes look. And it's a luxury consumer product. And if the end consumer, if that's what they want, if they're voting with their dollars and saying, that's how I want my bike to be, then it's our job to do it the best way possible and make it not a problem for them.
So you do have a problem next year that you're going to have to solve.
Well, there's always a problem to solve,
but no,
and we might not be the one solving it. There might, but you know, as cables go away and more electronic stuff comes, I understand where customers want to go, and some things we can take a stand on and say, yeah, that's not us. We're not going there. Other things, we got to kind of see how it plays out and then do the best version of it that there is.
The humility of doing what the customer wants.
Yeah, that's what we're here for. Building better bikes and making people's lives better and happier. And that means ride quality, but it also means satisfaction and that they love their ownership of their Pivot or whatever they're buying. And you want to look at it every day and be proud of it. And if there's something about that you don't like or wish was different, then it's our job to address that.
Well, I can see the happiness, feel the happiness here, because when I was making bicycles, when you hand over your bicycle, not only do you have something that you built, but you're not just selling bikes, you're selling happiness. I mean, I've raced motorcycles, I fly airplanes, I build airplanes. I have never stuck with anything as long as I've stuck with mountain bikes. And every time I come back from a mountain bike ride, I'm happy. Even if I was just, a 70-year-old cranky idiot when I left home, when I come back, I'm just like, yeah, especially on the last bike I have. I thank you very much for letting me ride one, but I've been riding the new Switchblade. And my question is, what would happen if that first bike you rode that you destroyed and handed over to your friend was the latest version of the Switchblade? If you started there, what would we be riding today?
I don't know.
Because that's somebody, I've been riding mountain bikes since almost the beginning of the sport. And I have never ridden a mountain bike that's been more fun than that one. It does everything I want. It never complains. It's quiet. It doesn't rattle. It shifts when I want to shift. It's not electric. And I kind of like that because it's like a four-stroke off-road motorcycle. You fill it full of gas and you leave it in your garage. And one day you wake up and you go, I want to ride my bike. And you kick it over or you hit the electric start button. It starts up and you go ride your bike. That's what it's like. It's waiting for me in my garage for that day when I look out.
When the snow melts and
When the snow melts and the trails are hard, I just throw it in the back of my car. And I don't even look at it except for, I'm anal about air pressure. And I'd go out and ride. And it's like a pal. It's a friend. And I can totally rely on it, And that's just like, if you're going to like end a life of completely being devoted to a mountain bike, this is the end. I don't have to have anything else. This is the end of my life here. I'll take this bike until my grave. And it's like, what would happen if you started your career with that bike, with the 2024 Switchblade was the first bike you ever rode? Could you make it better?
You can always make it better, but yeah, the gains are so much more incremental. And when I look at some of the brands and things that have launched, there's a lot of marketing and pow that goes behind more than necessarily is this truly a next level innovative product. I mean, there's a lot of, for us, there's innovation and there's evolution. And when we look at something like the e-bikes and we're on our fourth, fifth generation, and many of our competitors are on their first bike. And it's like, we know what you're going through. We know what you're going to go through. And so the experience matters in being able to do that. You got to start somewhere, and it is going to get better. It always is. But everything's so good. It's like, if you've ridden dirt bikes in the last 10 years, I can get on I've got a 2012 KTM in my garage, and I've got a 2023 Husqvarna. They're both 350s. They're both made by the same company, and they're both still great. They're both modern, and not a lot of things have changed on standards or anything since that time. One weighs almost 50 pounds less than
50.
Yeah.
That's substantial, especially for a little guy like me.
I'm comparing that to my wife's Honda, older Honda, but it was more like 35, 38 pounds. And you just sit on them, and there's enough differences. They both feel like a dirt bike. They both have electric starters. They both have fuel injection. They've got all the modern stuff. Suspension is, I think you could probably take the forks out of one and shove it in the other. No major standard changes, but tweak is a radically different picture between those two motorcycles. But it's not like I couldn't go out and race the 2012 and go just as fast. Whereas if you go back that many years in the bike, we don't have the same wheel sizes going. I mean, the geometry is radically different. And now mountain bikes are good. Geometry is good. And will it tweak a little here and there? Same as motorcycles. They're changing. Oh, the KTM changed their head angle half a degree and added more trail. Next year, they take the trail out and change their fork offset. And it's just like, we're kind of in that geometry's probably not going to have like major changes and revival. I don't know. I still think there should be a wheel size between 27 and a half and 29. I think that is going to be the sweet spot. But just putting that out there in case anybody from a tire rim side wants to do it, I'm in. The bike industry is in a great place, and people who start mountain biking now can really just concentrate on riding and having a great time. And that's just awesome when we can give a bike to somebody and they get their new bike and it changes their capabilities or their happiness. And they're just, we like getting Christmas cards and from customers and pictures of groups of people together with all their pivots. And it really drives what we do. It's nice. Cause Bill and I and Kevin, we could go sit in the back of a machine shop and knock out cool lugs and carbon tubes and build whatever we want just for us, but we don't want to do it just for us. So it's great to be able to kind of reap the happiness and rewards of seeing other people enjoy what we do.
Does riding a new bike that you created make you as happy as the last one made me?
I am completely driven by the next prototype. When's it going to be done, guys? I'm in the back and just like, how can we push this a little bit faster when a company doesn't get us a prototype or a sample part, that bike can't be built without that part. I'm the guy on the phone every day. Do you have a tracking number? What's going on?
Making people miserable for 35 years.
Yeah. Or telling my purchasing department, can you call them again? What's going on with that? What do you mean they closed for Christmas? So, yeah, we keep it fun.
That is true.
And we will keep it fun in the future. Not only the developing process we embrace so closely at Pivot, but also for you out there while riding our bikes. Our path towards making every bike better than before will continue, and we are excited to share our story along the way.